Whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to the second season of Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Yes. Hi, my name is Elizabeth Barnes, and I am a professor of philosophy at the University of Virginia. Go Hoos. And I work on, I guess, a wide range of issues, but I'm interested in areas of feminist philosophy, social philosophy, metaphysics, and I'm particularly probably most interested in the areas where these kind of topics interact. So I've written a book on the nature of disability and the relationship between disability and well-being. I've also been doing some work recently on gender, and right now I am in the middle of a book project on the nature of health and the value of health.
Well, I'm going to say I really, really like your book, The Minority Body, about disability, but I'm going to resist asking any questions about it now because I'm confident it's going to come up later. And if it doesn't, I'll ask my questions then. So I'm going to start with the Iris Murdoch question I always start with. She begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Yeah, so I found thinking about this question really interesting. I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of unflattering things about my temperament that probably influence my interest in philosophy and my attraction to philosophy. I'm sure I'm prone towards a certain type of narcissism, maybe obsessive thinking, tendency towards navel-gazing. Probably all of that has helped to steer me towards philosophy and influences my philosophy. But I will focus on the positive, because if I'm talking about myself, I'd rather talk about more positive aspects. So I guess I was thinking, in terms of just in general parts of my personality or temperament that would guide me to philosophy as a discipline, I have these sort of competing parts of my personality that maybe on the face of it don't sit all that well together. And one of them is that I have this tendency towards almost like a childlike sense of wonder or fascination with the world. I just find the world fascinating. I find things fascinating. I'm constantly sort of, you know, reading nonfiction and watching documentaries and, you know, looking at bugs in my yard. And I just want to find out about the world. I think what's true of a lot of philosophers is that little five-year-old child who's just constantly asking, what is that and why is that? And you never grew out of that phase. But the other side of that coin is that I have a part of me that's very cynical and very skeptical. And so there's like this part of me that's always asking questions and always fascinated, but then there's a part of me that's dissatisfied with all the answers and extremely skeptical of all the answers. And I think those two competing parts of myself have found a very natural home in philosophy. It's like you get to constantly ask questions and then constantly be dissatisfied with the answers. And so there's almost a sense in which philosophy has allowed me to make peace with these two sort of conflicting parts of myself. In terms of like aspects of my temperament that would influence my work more specifically, I found this one harder to think about. I guess maybe we're never all that good, I think, at analyzing our own work. But I guess the one thing that I thought maybe was that I'm in general a pretty optimistic person. I think I'm in general, just by nature, a pretty happy person. And I think that kind of comes through in my work. I think my work kind of comes from a place of general optimism. And I don't know whether people who would read it would see that in it, but I think that's definitely something that I feel when I'm writing it.
I mean, when you think about the competition between childlike wonder and cynicism, Can you see that playing out in different pieces of writing or pieces of work you've done in different ways? Are there some you think of as your cynical pieces and some things you've written that you think of as the childlike wondering essays that came out of that part of your personality?
You know, I actually, when I think about this, I think that both sides of me are present in most of the work that I do. One thing that's definitely been true of me when I'm doing philosophy is that I find it much easier to say what I don't like about other views, or indeed what I don't like about the views that I come up with myself, than what I think is probably true. But at the same time, it's not like that is then something that I experience as purely negative, because I feel like, you know, you can come up with objections to a view and that just leads you to further questions. That just leads you to further like, okay, well, why? Why is this a good objection? Why? So I think a lot of times my work is kind of me struggling to find balance and struggling to find nuance, which is like trying to put forward positive ideas, but then also dealing with like, you know, the skeptical demon that lives on my shoulder and just finds a problem with everything. And so, yeah, I think both sides of that are kind of always there with me. And it's me sort of wrestling with it every time I write.
I like that focus on not liking things, because for me, that is a big driver. And something I sometimes want to cultivate in students is, if you're not sure what to think, start with the features or the views or the aspects of people's thinking that you really hate, that you think, well, it can't be anything like that. And that can both be, I think, helpful in discovering where you at least want the truth to be and in motivating you to sort of pursue it.
That's funny. I often tell my students something similar, which is, you know, if you're looking for ideas for essays, you know, you go to that paper that really bugged you,
yeah,
that really rubbed you the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, can you find that bit where they say something and you're just like, no, that doesn't seem right. And then can you work out why? And one thing I find really interesting about that is I think we have this intellectual myth of ourselves as philosophers where, you know, we follow the argument where it leads. You know, we start with premises and then we build up to conclusions. And I don't know what your experience has been like. I'd be interested, but I think a lot of times for me, it often works the other way. It's like I have a hunch about a conclusion, and then I see if I can work my way backward to find some premises that will explain why my hunch is legitimate, or, you know, how I can support this thing that just seems like it's true, which isn't maybe the most rational way to approach things, but is definitely like how I have ended up writing a lot of papers.
No, I totally resonate to that. It's sort of, it's almost always for me reverse engineered, yeah, from the conclusion that I know I must end up at. Although I sometimes defend it to that makes it sound like rationalization. And one way I try to defend myself against that charge is by saying, I'm not trying to come up with the arguments that will convince someone it's true. I'm trying to figure out why it's true. And this is part of what you want really in a philosophical argument, ultimately, I think, is not just that it could persuade someone that the thing is true, but that it actually tells you why it's true, that it feels like an explanation as well as an argument. And that makes this sort of reverse engineering approach sound a little bit less disreputable, maybe.
Yeah, no, that's a nice way of framing it. That really resonates with me. I like that. And that's also, I guess, a sense in which, like, ultimately, maybe what you're trying to do is quiet down that inner 5-year-old that's just like, but why?
Yes, exactly.
Why exactly. Is this true?
Well, I want to ask you another question about philosophy and your personal life, which is this: has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in life?
Yeah, so again, I found this question really interesting, partly because I don't think I'd ever spent that much time thinking about it in these terms. But I think that kind of on reflection, probably in a lot of ways, philosophy is a big part of just, you know, how I deal with my life. Especially more recently. So, you know, I wrote my book on disability when I was, I have a physical disability, and the process of that disability is degenerative. So it gets worse over time. It gets worse as I age. And so in the course of writing the book that I wrote on disability, that was in the period in which I was transitioning from being invisibly disabled to being visibly disabled. And now I'm in the midst of writing this book on health. And it's been this period at which, like, my health status has just become much more complicated. And I think a lot of what's going on is just, you know, I'm spending a lot of time in waiting rooms and a lot of time at procedures. And I think one thing that people are often surprised by is what bothers me the most about living with this health condition isn't any of the big dramatic stuff. It isn't any of the big existential stuff or feeling like I'm missing out or, you know, I'm deprived in some way. It's often just the drudgery of it. It's just incredibly boring. it's the amount of my time it takes up. So I'll be sitting around, you know, I have to spend all this time doing physical therapy or all this time at the doctor or things. And so, you know, I just end up thinking like, well, what is health really? Like, why is health valuable? And so in a way, for me, I think it's both a way of getting some emotional distance from it. It's just like, well, let's just turn this into an abstract question. Let's just analyze this and, you know, find out what's interesting about it. But it's also a way, I think, probably because of how I think about philosophy, of making it beautiful, right? Of reintroducing that sense of wonder and interest. And it's like, oh, you know, I don't have any control over whether I'm sitting here having this procedure or sitting here in this waiting room, but I can make it interesting. I can ask these questions. And so I think for me personally, at least in the last decade, that has been just something that I've found really valuable and probably quasi-therapeutic. So probably in a sense, yes, philosophy has been really something that's helped me through things that are emotionally challenging and emotionally difficult.
It's really interesting to me that you don't frame the contribution of philosophy in terms of solving or ameliorating the disability and the difficulties associated with it themselves. It's more that it's sort of something else to think about or a way to make something of value out of them, something good out of them. Does that seem right to you? Or do you think there are direct ways in which philosophy can alleviate the sort of difficulty of being physically disabled?
I think there probably are many ways in which philosophy can ameliorate some of the direct harms, especially I think a lot about some of, you know, Miranda Fricker's work on epistemic injustice. So the idea of, you know, it sometimes being hard to come to knowledge of like a positive sense of yourself as a disabled person or a sense of disability pride. And there, I think the tools of philosophy can actually just be practically helpful in terms of dealing with the everyday realities of disability. But I think a lot of the time, just for me personally, when I'm thinking about the actual practice of doing philosophy, like, you know, writing papers and coming up with research agendas and that kind of thing, it does end up being this more indirect thing where, you know, there's just the practical drudgeries of my life. And in this way where I think a lot of times people who aren't disabled, they think of disability as this very big dramatic thing. Or like, oh no, what if I became disabled? It would be this grand tragedy in my life. When in fact, at least in my experience, the most difficult things are just boring. They're just deadly, deadly dull. And so it is this way of instilling interest into it, making it something that I can think about creatively and that I can process through. So yeah, I think it can be both and, but probably for my own experience of it, it's more of that just sort of instrumental approach to it.
Well, there are lots of other things I would love to ask you about this, but instead I'm going to shift to another question about your relation to philosophy. This is question 3. Do you really believe your philosophical views?
Yeah, I'm going to be totally honest about this. No. That maybe sounds more concessive or negative than I intended to, but I think for me, I think it would almost take a certain type of self-confidence that I don't have to think that I have actually managed to attain, you know, objective mind independent truth. Like everyone else since thousands of years ago has been trying, and finally it's culminated in my success. I think in general, what I hope for from my views is that I've managed to make some progress, right? That I've maybe managed to be like, okay, I think I'm kind of moving the ball in the right direction, or I'm getting us in the right part of the field or something. I'm kind of saying the answer is maybe this way, everybody. This is the general area we ought to be looking. Or maybe that I'm improving the kind of questions that are being asked. So I think of philosophy as very much a communal enterprise. So I hope that what I'm able to do is sort of offer something up that helps assist the broader conversation, maybe moves the broader conversation in a way that's helpful. But in doing that, I don't in any way think that I've actually gotten it right. I think I'm wildly skeptical that I've actually gotten it right. Sometimes that's just like a preface paradox worry, where I'm just kind of like, well, you know, I've checked the answers as best I can, but I'm pretty sure I've screwed something up just knowing my own fallibility. But a lot of times it is me running up against the fallibility of my own mind and realizing, like, you know, in the words of the great philosopher Taylor Swift, like, this is me trying. I'm doing my best, but I'm pretty sure this is not correct. But it's the best I can do. I don't, you know, a better philosopher would do better, but this is what I've got. That is very often where I find myself with my views.
Well, I have to say, I'm very excited because I think this is the first straight no that this question has got. I'm actually surprised too, because I sort of thought that more philosophers would sheepishly admit that no, they can't really claim to believe their philosophical views for reasons not dissimilar from the ones you gave, namely just the sheer improbability that, you know, I, Kieran Setia, have managed to figure it out after thousands of years of smarter people not figuring it out. How else do you characterize your relation to your views? So you said you want to make progress, but sort of cognitively or sort of like, what attitude do you have towards the views that you don't believe, but in some sense still defend and put forward?
Well, yeah, so it's a combination of things, because I think of philosophy as a communal enterprise. I do sometimes hope that I'm able to toss something out there that will then allow other people to take it up, and then they can make some progress, and, you know, together we can make the conversation better. But I do also sometimes have almost an aesthetic approach to how I'm thinking about this. Like, I think philosophy is beautiful, and I think it's beautiful that human beings ask these questions about, you know, we're just these organisms that are stuck on this rock hurtling through space, and we're looking around going, you know, what is the meaning of life? And what is truth? And what are tables really? And I think it's great that we ask questions like this. And I think the value of that is almost akin to like the value of art or the value of music. And I don't make any claim to the aesthetic value of my own philosophy. I don't think my own philosophy is that good, but the aesthetic value of the enterprise as a whole, the conversation as a whole, I do think is something that matters. So I think I do have like partly a cognitive approach to it, but also there is something that just like, I think it's beautiful. I think it's interesting. And so I think sometimes people worry that they're maybe just being disingenuous if they say that they don't believe their views, because like, well, how could you argue for them if you don't manage to believe them? But I think I can hope that they're doing better, or I can hope that they're an improvement, or I can hope that they're something worthwhile without actually being able to get myself into a headspace where I believe them, because I don't.
Well, I think maybe there's a natural transition from the beauty of philosophy, but also the thought that one's own philosophy really isn't that good, to question four. What, if anything, have you learned from failure in your philosophical life?
This is a great question. And this question really hit home for me, because I feel like, I don't know, maybe other people have a different relationship to their own work, but I feel like my entire philosophical trajectory has been me having to learn to deal with my own failure, because my work is just never as good as I want it to be. It's never as precise or as clear. And I so often run into these places where I wish that I could be smarter. I wish I could be a better thinker. I sometimes find myself wishing, if doing something like, I wish I could be more worthy of these ideas. These ideas are so cool. And these ideas in some cases are, you know, important and timeless. You know, I'm just me. And I am, you know, sometimes you're thinking about these things and it feels like swimming through quicksand. You're really, really running up against the limitations of your own mind. And I think in a large part, for me, learning to enjoy doing this for a living has been learning to be okay with that, right? Be okay with my limitations and my failures and the fact that I'm not going to get it right. And just making peace with that. I mean, like, yeah, okay, it's not perfect. Can I feel like it's good enough? And also, I think coming to a place where I realize that if I keep waiting to be satisfied, if I defer my happiness until I'm satisfied that my work is good enough, I'm never going to be happy because it's never going to be good enough. And that's led me to put a lot more value in things that I really feel like I can be good at and I can be successful at. Like, I mean, for me, that's my undergraduate teaching. Like, that's the thing in my life that really makes me feel like I'm good at something, and it's how I sleep well at night. And my work, you know, I wish it could be better, but it is a study in failure, and I'm okay with that.
I really, really like that. Yeah. It reminds me of a story. I think I'm not going to name names, but I was having a conversation with a prolific, well, not excessively prolific, but a productive, successful philosopher about a colleague who was very tortured about writing. And I remember him shaking his head and saying mournfully, his problem is he's afraid to be wrong. And I thought, that's right. You can't be afraid to be wrong. I mean, it in philosophy, unless you have the kind of ego that enables you to think, I'm not going to be wrong. It is going to be me who figures out the final truth. Then not being afraid to be wrong is sort of a condition of being able to continue with the kind of questions that philosophers tend to ask. So I'm gonna ask you another question about fear then. This is the final question. This is the other Iris Murdoch question, beginning with another quote. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
Yeah, so I noticed that so many of the people that you've interviewed have had these philosophically interesting answers to this question, where they have things that they're afraid of that are related to their work and things like that. But if I am answering this question honestly, there's one thing that immediately springs to mind if you ask me what I'm afraid of. And that is that something happens to my husband. I've been so lucky in my life to have this one amazing love. And I often feel like I don't actually tend to be afraid of many things. And I think one reason that I'm not is that I just kind of feel like as long as, you know, he and I are together, we'll work it out. It'll be fine. We'll get by. And I think part of it then means that I do have this overwhelming fear that something will happen to him. Partly because I know that if something did happen to him, I wouldn't be okay. I really wouldn't be okay. And I guess I was thinking about my response to this question, and in a way, I think maybe it is related to some of my philosophical work, because I think a lot of the work that I've done, especially recently, I've been grappling with these issues related to well-being, related to flourishing, where the things that are most valuable in our lives are also the things that are just inevitably intertwined with the things that have the most, you know, potential to cause pain and cause tragedy and cause hurt and cause loss. And they can be intertwined in these ways that are just kind of inextricably linked. You can't really have one without the other. And I think in some ways, love is kind of like that. And so, yeah, that is my one big fear. If I had to give a fear that I think was directly related to something that I've worked on, I do think a lot about preference and adaptation and adaptation to disability and illness. And I think one thing that people often talk about when they talk about disability is, you know, they're worried that they won't adapt, or they're worried that they won't be happy. I actually think the older that I get, I am most afraid of my ability to adapt. Here's a story that might be apocryphal, but a friend of mine told me this about Yorkshire tea. So he said that Yorkshire tea, everyone's granny's favorite tea, the only tea that they'll drink, wanted to sell weaker tea that would be cheaper. But they didn't want to have, you know, the grannies of the UK abandon Yorkshire tea. And so they started slowly weakening the tea gradually. But they did it in ways that were like pairwise indistinguishable. So each box that you bought, you wouldn't be able, if you poured a cup of tea, to tell the difference between this box and the previous box. And they did this slowly over a period of like 10 or 15 years. And by the end of the process, people were drinking weak tea, but insisting that, like, oh, Yorkshire tea is the only tea I would ever drink. And, you know, they still loved their Yorkshire tea, but they didn't realize it was this much weaker, inferior product. And it was probably the case by that point that if you'd given them the tea they'd drunk 15 years ago, they'd be like, what is that? That's too bitter. I don't like it. So if I'm afraid of anything related to the kind of stuff I've worked on, I'm afraid of Yorkshire tea.
Yeah.
I am afraid that, you know, slowly over time, the richness and the color and the vibrancy could get drained from my life. And it would happen so gradually that I wouldn't notice and I wouldn't be able to do anything about it. And I've seen that some with the changes in the pandemic. You know, there's like the walls just kind of close in and it gets smaller. And it just, if it happens gradually enough, you barely even notice that your preferences have changed. And I think your life can become smaller and less rewarding and less rich in that sort of almost ceritical gradual change way. So yeah, I'm afraid of Yorkshire tea.
Well, that's an amazing story. So we'll end with the real life phenomenal sorites, and one that's possibly happening to us now as we slowly relinquish contact with other people under the pandemic and forget what real life was actually like. And I'll say thank you, Elizabeth, for appearing on the podcast.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Elizabeth Barnes is professor of philosophy at the University of Virginia and the author of The Minority Body. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.